It's the Book of the Month on Southside Broadcasting with Jenny Finch and a team of top writing talent.
This month's book is The Timeships by Stephen Baxter. The Timeships is an official sequel to H.G. Wells's great novel The Time Machine, authorised by the executors of Wells's estate. Using Wells's universe and main characters, it takes the reader on a second journey into the future, this time to rescue Weena, the young female Eloy the narrator abandoned to the evil Morlocks in the original novel. Utilising the same machine as in Wells's novel, the traveller sets off, only to find the whole world is altered in the future. The Morlocks are highly developed and intelligent, and the Eloy no longer exist. Adopted by one Morlock, who acts as both teacher and guardian, the traveller experiences life in the new Sphere universe before escaping and returning to Victorian London.
"Our occupations are not as consuming as yours," he said. "I have two loves, two vocations." His eyes were invisible, making his emotions even more impossible to read. He said, "Physics and the training of the young." Education and training of all sorts continued throughout a Morlock's lifetime, and it was not unusual for an individual to pursue three or four careers, as we might call them, in sequence, or even in parallel. The general level of intelligence of the Morlocks was, I got the impression, rather higher than that of the people of my own century. Still, Niebuhr Gipfel's choice of vocation startled me. I had thought that Niebuhr Gipfel must specialise solely in the physical sciences, such was his ability to follow my sometimes rambling accounts of the theory of the time machine and the evolution of history. "Tell me," I said lightly, "for which of your talents were you appointed to supervise me? Your expertise in physics, or your nannying skills?" I thought his black, small-toothed mouth stretched in a grin. Then the truth struck me, and I felt a certain humiliation burn in me at the thought. I am an eminent man of my day, and yet I had been put in the charge of one more suited to shepherding children. And yet, I reflected now, what was my blundering about when I first arrived in the year 657-208, but the actions of a comparative child? Now Niebuhr Gipfel led me to a corner of the nursery area. This special place was covered by a structure about the size and shape of a small conservatory, done out in the pale, translucent material of the floor. In fact, this was one of the few parts of that city chamber to be covered over in any way. Niebuhr Gipfel led me inside the structure. The shelter was empty of furniture or apparatus, save for one or two of the partitions with glowing screens, which I had noticed elsewhere. And in the centre of the floor there was what looked like a small bundle of clothing, perhaps, being extruded from the glass. The Morlocks who attended here had a more serious bent than those who supervised the children, I perceived. Over their pale hair they wore loose smocks, vest-like garments with many pockets, crammed with tools which were mostly quite incomprehensible to me. Some of the tools glowed faintly. The latest class of Morlock had something of the air of the engineer, I thought. It was an odd attribute in this sea of babies. And although they were distracted by my clumsy presence, the engineers watched the little bundle on the floor and passed instruments over it periodically. My curiosity engaged, I stepped towards that central bundle. Niebuhr Gipfel hung back, letting me proceed alone. The thing was only a few inches long, and was still half embedded in the glass, like a sculpture being hewn from some rocky surface. In fact, it did look a little like a statue. Here were the buds of two arms, I thought, and there was what might become a face, a disc coated with hair and split by a thin mouth. The bundle's extrusion seemed slow, and I wondered what was so difficult for the hidden devices about manufacturing this particular artifact. Was it especially complex, perhaps?
At the core of the story is the idea of parallel universes, a series of differing futures, and the impact time travel might have on the past. As soon as the traveller arrives in the future a second time, he is made aware that he himself has changed it by his previous expedition, and on returning to his own past, he sets in motion a series of changes leading to a 24-year world war with Germany. Both sides have access to time travel and carry the war back and forth through different ages, moving back to pre-human times, witnessing the first atom bomb, and establishing a settlement where London will stand in one future or another, before escaping forwards once more, finally locating the universe first visited in Wells's novel. Of all these, the Eternal War universe is particularly interesting and will please any reader who enjoys alternative histories. The Time Ships pays homage to Wells's original works in a number of ways, from the Victorian-style prose employed by the narrator to the numerous references to his characters in the story. But it is not necessary to have read the original to understand the sequel. The Time Machine is a much shorter work than Baxter's, running to roughly 100 pages compared to this weighty 630. A good proportion of Baxter's work is concerned with science, much of it real science, as he explains the quirks of time travel, theories of alternative universes, and a host of engineering ideas in some considerable detail. This adds a new dimension to the traveller's tale, and in some way, the work loses part of the charm of the original, which reads in our technologically advanced age almost as steampunk.
The Morlock's red grey eye turned back to the pyramid, and that tube of extruded metal sank into the hole in his face with a liquid noise. "This constructor is not a single machine like a motor car," he retorted. "It is a composite, made up of many millions of submachines, limbs, if you like. These are arranged in a hierarchical form, radiating out from a central trunk along branches and twigs, after the manner of a bush. The smallest limbs at the periphery are too small for you to see. They work at the molecular or atomic levels." "But what use," I asked, "are these insectile limbs? One may push atoms about, and molecules, but why? What a tedious and unproductive business." "On the contrary," he said wearily, "if you can do your engineering at the most fundamental level of matter, and if you have enough time and sufficient patience, you can achieve anything." He looked up at me. "Why, without the constructor's molecular engineering, you and I would not even have survived our first exposure to white earth." "What do you mean?" "The surgery performed on you," Niebuhr-Gipfel said, "was at the level of the cell, the level where the frost damage occurred." Niebuhr-Gipfel described in some grisly detail how, in the severe cold we had encountered, the walls of my very cells and his had been burst open by the freezing and expansion of their contents, and no surgery of the type I was familiar with could have saved my life. Instead, the microscopic outer limbs of the constructor had become detached from the parent body and had travelled through my damaged system, effecting repairs of my frostbitten cells at the molecular level. When they reached the other side, crudely speaking, they had emerged from my body and rejoined their parent. I had been rebuilt from the inside out by an army of swarming metal ants, and so had Niebuhr-Gipfel. I shuddered at this, feeling colder than at any time since my rescue. I scratched at my arms almost involuntarily, as if seeking to scrape out this technological infection. "But such an invasion is monstrous," I protested to Niebuhr-Gipfel. "The thought of those busy little workers passing through the substance of my body. I take it you would prefer the blunt, invasive scalpels of the surgeons of your own age? Perhaps not, but I remind you that, by contrast, you could not even set a broken bone without rendering me lame." "But that was different. I'm no doctor." "Do you imagine this creature is?" In any event, if you would prefer to have died, no doubt that could be arranged. Of course not. But I scratched at my skin, and I knew it would be a long time before I felt comfortable again in my own rebuilt body. I thought of a drop of comfort, though. At least, I said, these limb things of the constructor are merely mechanical. What do you mean? They're not alive. If they had been. He pulled his face free of the constructor and faced me, the hole in his face sparkling with metal cilia. No, you are wrong. These structures are alive.
Baxter has just completed another sequel to one of Wells's classics, The Massacre of Mankind, which follows on from War of the Worlds. As well as these Wells novels, he's published a number of other books, including five with Terry Pratchett. A number of his novels are classed as hard science fiction, meaning rooted in scientific fact rather than difficult to read. Some parts of The Time Ships are quite demanding, but the detail and accuracy of his writing makes the alternative history aspects in particular rewarding and accessible to all.
In today's crowded world, it's sometimes hard to get heard. And sometimes you need a little extra push to be heard. That's where Manila PR can help. We specialise in online radio and press for independent bands, with prices to match, and have been doing so for the last decade. So if you have a noise to make, make it with Manila. Visit manilapr.com now.
Being selected by Jenny Finch and her team for the Book of the Month is quite frankly one of the pinnacles of any writer's ambition. Don't ask me how I know this. I just do.
The Midweek Drive and the Midweek Drive Morning Edition. Two radio shows you can enjoy live, online and around the world from sironline.co.uk.
Strokes affect 130,000 people in England and Wales each year. Here's a recipe that can dramatically decrease your chances of strokes.
Excellent. I better get a pen.
167 grams of calcium, 225
grams of magnesium, 3 grams of zinc. Hang on, slow down.
Remember, any more than one tablespoon could kill you. Any less than one tablespoon could kill you.
Right, what was
and
the recipe?
That's the recipe.
Oh,
if
damn.
You would like a more simple solution, then you can always call Pharma Nord on 01670 519989.
All right.
Or visit the website pharmanord.co.uk.
Let me see if I can jot that down. What was the number again?
01670 519989. Or visit the website pharmanord.co.uk.
And how do you spell Pharma Nord, I wonder?
pharmanord.co.uk.
It's almost as if I'm having a conversation with the radio.
Don't be silly, that's impossible.
Pharma Nord, winning the war of nutrition.
You're listening to a Southside Broadcasting podcast. Southside Broadcasting is a media company which aims to provide a wide range of features from the rural, health and lifestyle worlds. You can regularly listen to entertaining podcasts with interviews and correspondence from Los Angeles, Nashville, New York and London. You can take part in our Book of the Month features, grab some great nutritional advice, enjoy broadcasts from the Great Yorkshire Show, the Lincolnshire Show, and enjoy local football reviews with our regular feature, Fly Me to the Moon. You can even hear a BAFTA award-winning director drive a train full of teddy bears. You can listen to these and many more podcasts at southsidebroadcasting.podbean.com. For further information on how you can join over 35,000 people who regularly download our podcasts, call us on 01642 854 742 or email info@southsidebroadcasting.com now.
You're listening to Jenny Finch, crime writer, scholar, and commentator, with another classic book of the month on Southside Broadcasting. Crime writer. That means she authors the crimes. She's the mastermind behind the crimes. Oh, is this recording?
Yes, it is. It's another great book of the month. First book of the month for 2017, of course. We have travelled in time since we last gathered together in this technological studio, moved forward with our friends, the Morlocks, Nebo Gipfel, and others. And Rob, what did you make of this epic tome by, of course, the very commendable and award-winning science fiction writer and scientist, of course, Stephen Baxter?
Yes, it is an epic tome. I think The first impressions, it's a long time ago since I read the original, but it's great that
he captures the concept of time there.
Yeah, indeed. It's great that he captures the essence of writing, like in the Victorian style, H.G. Wells, Jules Verne, people like that, that really, the way that they capture everything.
Baxter's gone on record as saying he shares the views of the late Arthur C. Clarke that this was not merely a novella, this was a touchstone in the genre of science fiction, in terms of the ideas that are expressed from the perspective of Darwinian evolution, from the perspective of concepts of new thinking, written obviously when Britain was at the heart of its empire, and in a very productive field for Wells, where in essence one Stephen Baxter Timeships equals all of Wells' initial output, really, of The Time Machine, Island of Dr. Moreau, War of the Worlds, and of course The Invisible Man. That's before he goes on to Things to Come and other sort of areas. So very much held up as a founding father of contemporary science fiction.
Yeah, obviously springing from a time, as you mentioned, Darwin, a time of incredible scientific advances, and then leading to a First World War, of course, that it was a big full stop, and a massive shock. I like the way that he goes back, Stephen Baxter, and he has a Victorian view of the future in certain ways, but then can bring the most modern science to bear with it as well.
And of course, some wonderful name checks. I mean, footballer Albert Stubbins.
Yeah, I know. Yes.
Crops in there, so you've got, you know, genuine characters emerging. I thought the way in which he incorporated some of the early scientists and the sort of lines of that was very cleverly done, and I think sort of gave it a grounding nature in the reality. The other thing which I again share with Jenny, the other aspect, one of the gripes I've always had with the original novella, and it's possibly Wells's writing and again of his era, he doesn't really do justice to the genders. You know, it's very masculine style that comes across. Wiener by no extent can be seen as a major leading light, but I think what Baxter's introduced in the character of Helen and the captain here is you've at least got a little bit more of an issue there, and arguably when we get into the far future, the constructors, the gender issue has become, you know, immaterial. You know, people simply develop and choose their own ways. I mean, Jenny, from your own perspective, did you, you know, in terms of identification, because, you know, let's face it, Wiener, wee little girl,
has to be saved.
Exactly. I'm not sure whether she was whether he abandoned her. I think he possibly sort of left her there, because was she not kidnapped, or the time machine went, and so on. And
he felt he'd abandoned her. I think. And as far as the gender thing is concerned, that was the thing that struck me most for quite a bit of the novel, until we got to the alternative futures and we got the captain and stuff, and I thought, well, okay, yeah, he's doing his best. But an awful lot of most science fiction, even nowadays, tends to be still very masculine and very male biased.
Little tribute, of course, to an author that sadly passed away recently. Would you like to just share with us? She passed away last year, of course, the legend that is
Sherry S. Tepper.
Exactly. A whole range of things. And talking about names, Moses. Is that really the name of the time traveller, or is it simply the name that he gives to his younger self? Because we never know, and I've often sort of played around with the notion that, an Edwardian-dressed gentleman time traveller, no name, who is he? As in a doctor, or not? Is that? I mean, clearly, I think Doctor Who does owe a great deal to the original time machine. But what do you think, Rob, in terms of the name Moses that's actually used? I mean, clearly, there's a metaphor there for somebody who leads somebody out into the wilderness and the notion of that. And what would, if you went back 20 years to the young Rob Nichols, what would you name the young Rob Nichols?
Well, I wouldn't name him a name that he didn't like, because that was the first thing, wasn't it? It was his first instance. He was annoyed about it. No, it's interesting. Yeah, I like the way that the guy's quite a flawed person. He's got a real temper all the time, hasn't he?
It was an angry young man.
Yeah, but he continued to be, didn't he? But perhaps he recognised that himself as he looked back.
The total war situation, the very depressing war situation that comes through from that perspective. Jenny, you mentioned about sort of the steampunk elements of that. I think that maybe could have been reduced slightly if we were sort of being, you know, nitpicky about the whole thing. But did you think any of the philosophical issues relating to time and travel and that whole, the far future? Because clearly, yeah, we go to literally the end of the universe, the beginning of the universe, and then it all begins again. Was that, you know, something which you thought was, is that part of the fun of the science fiction, the epic notion, the epochal spanning world?
I think it is. I also think that the point that comes through, though it's not necessarily made explicitly, is we really don't have any right to start messing about with other people's lives and futures and everything else, because what he does is to eliminate whole swathes of people and then bring them back again in a different form. And enough already, leave them alone, that's their world.
Non-interference directive.
Absolutely.
Looking at the way in which the text sort of opens up, I was quite surprised to find myself actually warming to the character of Nebo Gipfel, because my impression of the Morlocks were very much the George Powell movie of the 1960s, and you thought scary, white, pale-faced people who admittedly like to live underground and eat from the Eloi consume the Eloi as their food and cattle and so on. But it was interesting, I think, the way in which we saw things which, you know, you might sort of say that's a very, very fascinating engineering thing, the notion of sort of circumventing the sun and the earth and putting some sort of huge dome and biosphere there. There's some really big concepts there, not to be confused with the Mexican wall, of course, which is the only political point I'll make.
No, not to be confused.
Exactly. But I mean, how did you find Nebo Gipfel was presented? Did you sort of think in the end, because I mean, he gets bashed around quite a lot.
He does. he's very resilient. He's a great sort of intellect and philosopher and basically part of a race that it's just all about consuming knowledge, isn't it? And processing knowledge and
no difference between the engineer and the teaching in terms of the roles that they actually have and how they actually work through that basis.
I like that.
Favourite characters for yourself, Jenny?
I quite like the Morlock, to be honest, because
you're not going
to
say Nebo Gipfel, are you?
I know. I can't.
It's okay.
I actually warmed to him much more than I did the narrator, who is angry, stays angry, behaves angry, and actually I think just deserves a good slap. And it's the poor old Morlock who gets the slap. And that's
So if we're looking at points and scoring from that perspective, given that clearly we could change this again if we go back in time to the start of the programme and actually revamp the whole sort of system, how do you know? We're actually providing this as a podcast. People can actually listen to it whenever they wish. They might be listening to it 100 years in the future. It may be out there. But what at this particular moment, in this particular reality, Rob, would you actually give Stephen Baxter's The Time Ships?
I give it 9.
I'm going to go 9 as well, because I thought it was, enjoyable. And although you made a key point about the size and the complexity, I actually found it, you know, there are certain books over in the 600-plus range which you think, but this one, I felt the flow was actually there and it did work. And I've kind of avoided some of Stephen Baxter's writing, partly as a result of the sort of mega nature of the whole system. We did Terry Pratchett, obviously, just before Christmas. And his collaborations with Terry, again, it was sort of quite epic, but again, open up a whole range of other elements. Jenny?
Because I think it is too long and could benefit with some editing, I'm going to give it an 8.
And as a writer, as we know, and a whole range of things, which classic novel would you like to do a contemporary update on, if we're looking at the whole sequence? Is there an area where, you know, you look back and say, well, it's time to find out what really Pierre Bezukhov did after War and Peace?
I have to say, I'm not a great fan of that concept. It's become quite a big thing. Mm. You've got Death Comes to Pemberley, and you've got Dickensian, and you've got Elementary. Yeah. And a part of me goes, enough already. Let's have an original story. Let's not mess with things that are that classic, that are that good. Let's make our own stories. I probably wouldn't.
If Stephen Baxter wants to do an updated version of Alex Hastings, then, would you just think?
He would have to go through me.
And that's the estate of the author talking in full force. The message is there. Next month, February, what are we looking forward to? We're travelling again in time and in space, but it's not science fiction. It's a classic, and it's a gentleman, an author who's been with us before and is coming back again.
It is indeed. Next month, we're going to be looking at John Steinbeck's comedy masterpiece, Cannery Row.
Being selected by Jenny Finch and her team for the Book of the Month is quite frankly one of the pinnacles of any writer's ambition. Don't ask me how I know this. I just do.